Ballots in Broward County and two red congressional districts turn blue. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Another election and the focus falls on ballots in our region again. Three statewide races could be headed for a recount. Vote totals in the races for governor, U.S. Senate, and agriculture commissioner are changing thanks mostly to the count continuing in Broward and Palm Beach counties. Democrats flipped two congressional districts in South Florida, helping the party take control of the U.S. House of Representatives. So how did Republicans lose the seats, and what could be the impact on the Florida delegation on Capitol Hill? Miami voters, meantime, okay talks that may lead to a soccer stadium, but they reject a strong mayor form of government. It's election 2018. Your phone calls and tweets coming up on the South Florida Roundup. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio in South Florida. Well, the Sunshine State once again and still counting ballots on this Friday afternoon. The election now has lasted three more days in at least three major statewide races. The contests for U.S. Senate, governor, and agriculture commissioner are so close to call, they're likely headed for recounts. And caught in the middle, Broward County. Broward's canvassing board is meeting again right now on this Friday afternoon, reviewing 238 more provisional ballots. As of yesterday afternoon, the supervisor of elections office had accepted 205 of the more than 600 provisional ballots cast in the election. Eva DeCayardi drove from southwest Broward Thursday to check that her mail-in ballot had been verified. Elections officials confirmed it was counted, but she was still frustrated.
I called all morning long and I couldn't get through. So then I drove here, which is like a 45-minute drive, to make sure that I got an answer, that I could see for myself that my vote was counted. It should not be this guessing game.
The elections office blames the long ballot and the number of votes for the long counting process in Broward County. More than 700,000 people cast votes in this week's election. Thursday afternoon, Broward County Mayor Beam Furr came to see how the process was going. He has been on a previous elections canvassing board.
You know, it does take a while to go through all the absentee ballots. People don't realize the enormity of how many things they have to check. This is a correct signature. Is this the right person who's on the ballot? And unfortunately, because it takes time, suspicions grow. And I don't like that.
Also in Broward, observing the vote counting is William Scherer. He is an attorney for Rick Scott's Senate campaign. This is not his first fight over Florida votes. He worked for the Bush campaign in 2000 and its fight with Al Gore over Florida's presidential votes then.
It was a dogfight from beginning to end. And we had, just like we're having today, we had the supervisor of elections not being transparent, not knowing how many ballots haven't been counted, how many have, why haven't they been counted.
Politics and process here in play this Friday after the 2018 election day. So how worried are you about your vote counting? What questions do you have about the vote counting process, so where it goes from here? 800-743-WLRN all across South Florida, 800-743-9576. The conversation also on our Twitter account, at WLRN, is our handle there. Charles Zeldin is with us via Skype. He is a professor at Nova Southeastern University. He has studied elections and voting. Professor, thank you for your time and for joining us here. First, let's start here. Compare and contrast where we are in this 2018 election vote count process compared to the last high water benchmark of Florida vote counting, which was in the fall of 2000 with the presidential race.
The biggest issue or biggest difference is that in 2000, it came as a surprise and the law wasn't clear about how to handle recounts. There was, in fact, no law procedure for having a statewide recount. The law has been cleaned up. It's very clear. If there are half of 1% gap between the candidates, you go to a machine recount. If it is a quarter of 1% gap between the candidates, you go to a hand recount. So it's very clear when the recounts kick in. Yep. And how the process goes. So, on the other hand, oh, go ahead.
So I want to dig into that just a little bit about the process, because there's even questions around there. And you know how lawyers can be. With all due respect, let's make sure we understand what the law says. Does the Secretary of State, who is kind of the head of the elections process when it comes to the state, does that office have to order a recount, even if that the mathematical numbers, as you just described, are in play? Or does it automatically happen with or without the office technically issuing the order?
As I understand it, the office is required to hold a recount, to order a recount, if these numbers are matched. Basically, what the legislature wanted to do was to take away any doubt,
yeah,
in terms of when there's a recount, how the recount will be held, and so if you hit the benchmark, the recount happens.
And now let me ask you this question, Professor. The benchmark of 0.5% or less would require an automated machine recount. 0.25% or less in the differential between the two candidates would require a manual recount. That manual recount right now, in terms of the three races that are likely to go into recount, is the Commissioner of Agriculture race. Will that race first go through the automatic recall and then a manual recount, or will it automatically go straight to the manual recount?
I believe they will probably run it through the machines anyhow as a way to pull out questionable ballots. One of the ways to simplify hand recounts is you run it through the machines, and any case in which there is an undervote, no one voted for the office, or there's an overvote, it was voted two votes were listed, you pull those out, because those are ones you're going to have to look at very closely. Then you do quicker to go through the other ones and just simply see, okay, there's a mark for the Democrat, there's a mark for the Republican. And the Scantrons are going to be easier to determine the intent of the voter than the old CHAD system was.
So I wanted to ask you, there's the infamous picture in Palm Beach County from November of 2000 with a worker looking at one of those butterfly ballots with the CHADs in it with a magnifying glass. Are we going to see something similar this time around? Could we see something similar without the CHADs necessarily, but trying to decide,
yes,
is
yes,
that oval officially filled in correctly and properly and fully?
Yes, that will exactly will happen. It won't. They won't necessarily be holding it up into the air to get the light to shine through, but they will possibly be using magnifying glasses to see, is there a mark that the machine missed? Is that a mark that has nothing to do with the vote? Is it an attempt to fill in the oval? Florida law requires that if you can show the intent of the voter, if you can determine the intent of the voter, you have to count that vote. So what if there's a mark, a circle mark outside the oval? The person just missed it.
Mm-hmm.
That would, on the machine, would show no vote,
right.
But in person, you'd look at it and say, okay, it's right next to the vote for Rick Scott. It just isn't in the oval, or it's just barely in the corner of the oval. But clearly this person was trying to mark next to Rick Scott. We count this as a vote for Rick Scott.
So, for instance, one of the mysteries here is the undervote when it comes to the U.S. Senate race in Broward County compared to the other statewide races. There are upwards of 30,000 fewer votes cast in Broward County, as we're now talking on this Friday afternoon, in the U.S. Senate race in Broward County compared to the number of votes tabulated in Broward County for the governor's office, for the attorney general's office, for the agriculture commissioner's office. As they go through this automatic recount, will they be looking for those kinds of X's or circles outside the oval perhaps make up for that undervote?
There's two possible explanations, or likely explanations, what's going on. One is the voters missed that particular vote. It was at the bottom left corner of the front page. It was easy to overlook. If they didn't think, wait, what about the Senate race, and go back looking for it, they may have just simply have skipped it. In which case, if you look at it and there's no marks there at all, clearly it's an undervote. They did not vote whether they wanted to originally or not. But if you start seeing marks around it, then you're in a situation in which it's possible they intended to vote, and that they made a mark close enough that we can determine what their intent was, and that should then be counted as an actual vote, but the machines wouldn't read it as such.
Charles Zeldin is with us via Skype. Professor, let me introduce you to the audience who may have just tuned in here to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Great to have you along. Charles is a professor at Nova Southeastern University and expert on the history of Florida recounts. Quite a subject. I guess if you're going to specialize in political recounts, you got to be in Florida for that, probably, Professor.
It definitely helps.
It certainly does. Your phone calls are at 800-743-9576 and also on Twitter at WLRN. A couple of phone calls about the process here, Professor, if you'll stick with us. Juan in Inverness is along with us. Juan, go ahead. Your thoughts.
Good afternoon, guys. How you doing?
Good. Your question.
All right, Mom. I have a question. My wife went to a boat, and while she was filling up her ballot to filling it up, she made a mistake. And so she went and asked for another one. She said that the lady took her ballot, put it in an envelope, and took it away. My question will be, what happened to those ballots? What's the process of I don't know, getting rid of them? Or
sure. So she was at a polling place. She took one ballot that was printed out. She made a mistake. She went to the poll worker and said, I made a mistake. I need a new ballot. That first ballot was taken, sealed off into an envelope. You want to know what happened to it?
Yes.
Gotcha. Professor, can you help him out?
Yeah, the way it's supposed to work and probably did work is those ballots are put aside. They're a different ballot than envelope than they would be for other ballots, and they would literally be delivered to the supervisor's office where they would be put aside, not counted, and ultimately would be destroyed. What they probably did when they put it in the envelope is there's a bar on the side that they take off. And that bar on the side, basically means that it can't be run through the machines now and be counted. So what they're doing is they make sure it can't be counted. They put it in the envelope and they put it aside for essentially be collected and it'll be held, but not counted.
Professor, let me ask you about the timeline here. We've had questions about the what some will declare as a compressed timeline. Senator Nelson is suing, asking for more time for counties to go through the count and any potential recount process. The timeline here would run really through not even the end of this month in terms of a automatic recount. A machine recount would be due on November 15th. A manual recount would be due, I believe it is on November, is it 16th or 18th, I think. I'm trying to read my own handwriting here.
It's something like that,
yeah,
yes.
But November 20th is when the Elections Canvassing Commission meets to certify the official results. November 20th is when the book is closed, according to the state's timeline.
Yes, but also keep in mind that by that point, it's probably caught up in the courts, and the courts can extend the process. Under the rules, yep. There is a request for a recount, but then you can also challenge the results.
Mm-hmm.
And the way those rules generally work is that it's then sent to a court in Leon County, and a judge is assigned to oversee the challenge. This is where you challenged the votes that were included. This is you challenged the timeline. And that process can extend beyond these deadlines.
Professor, hold on. WLRN's Katie Swiltowski, our Broward County reporter, is with us now just outside the canvassing board meeting. Katie, what can you tell us the latest at this 1 o'clock hour?
Hi, Tom. It's definitely a more chaotic scene than yesterday. There's a lot more people here, but the public and press are not being allowed inside yet. So while we know the canvassing meeting to count the last 238 provisional ballots was supposed to start at 1, we're not sure that it has started on time. We're still being kept outside in quite a crowd.
And kept outside how, Katie? This is a process, the canvassing board process is a process that is a public process. The public is allowed.
It has to be an open meeting.
That's right.
Yes. There's 5 security guards and a locked door right now. It looks like they're just buying time and waiting, trying to set up some wands and security measures to scan people. But I would say the crowd compared to yesterday is much more than 100 people more that are interested in coming.
And tell us,
it's a small room as well.
Right. Yeah. It only fits what, maybe a few dozen people in terms of outside
exactly.
of the poll, outside of the election supervisors, workers, in terms of public and press and lawyers, it's just a few dozen seats, kind of like a courtroom almost.
Yes, and now they have let in all attorneys from every campaign that's come up so far. So Nelson attorneys are inside, Scott attorneys, Caldwell and Freed attorneys are also inside.
So the campaign lawyers have been let in, but the public,
yes,
the general public and the press, the media has not been let in.
That is correct.
Katie Swietalski with us in Broward County. I'll let you go back and concentrate. Keep us updated on that. Professor, what does that tell you about the process there in Broward County?
That it's contentious, that
yeah,
they're being careful. The lawyers, they're going to allow the lawyers in. At this point, what they're doing is probably talking about how they're going to go about doing the observation of the absentee ballots and the counting. So this is actually a preparatory meeting before they get actually into the process. And so the lawyers are there watching and arguing with them over the preparatory meeting.
Yeah.
Once they've settled on what they're going to do, they'll start opening it up so that the press and the public can observe.
I'm going to bring in another quick call here, Professor. But real, I mean, you spoke initially about how the rules have been put into place since the 2000 presidential vote recount. And has kind of put forth a path about how these things are to be processed. But as we kind of just heard from Katie and you just spoke about, the attorneys for the campaigns are potentially right now talking about the rules of the process, about how to engage as they look at signatures, compare signatures, they look at ovals. Is this oval filled in? Is this oval not filled in?
Exactly.
So that kind of process.
And they're also at this point, they're looking at the absentee ballots. And there's a number of things that they have to check in an absentee ballot. Is the signature match?
Right.
Is it properly dated? Did you sign the back of the envelope properly? There are a number of things that if through mistake by the voter, nothing major, but by not filling it out exactly properly, results in that ballot
yeah,
not being a ballot to be counted.
Professor, let me squeeze in a call here
that
from Dania Beach here before we go to a break. Paula has been very patient. Go ahead, Paula, your thoughts.
Oh, hello. I love it. It's all so interesting. But since you're talking about so many little picayune problems, here's another one.
Okay.
When I got my driver's license, you sign it at the end with one of those electrical pens mm-hmm. on an electrical pad, you know, like you do when you use your card at Publix. And one thing I learned very well was, I was told that when you sign your ballot, it must match your signature mm-hmm. on your driver's license exactly.
That's
most people wouldn't.
Right. You know, if you go and show up at a polling place, thanks, Paula, for that phone call. If you show up at a polling place, Professor, you usually give the poll worker your ID and it has your signature on it, and I don't know about you, my driver's license is 9.5 years old and counting. I just got my renewal notice, so that signature on there dates back almost a decade, and for it to exactly match my signature today, it could be arguable on the part of the poll worker.
In-person voting, if it's close, they're usually willing to go with
yeah.
it because you have a picture ID.
Yeah.
So they have a pretty good idea that you are you. With absentee ballots, though, they don't have that picture ID. And so they have to look a little closer. So when, one of the things that I tell people when they're voting absentee is definitely do it, but make sure to be careful about how you sign. Essentially, what they're looking for is not, is your W or your L a little different, but they're looking to see that you signed it the same way. If you signed your name with your first, middle, and last name for your driver's license, you need to do that for the ballot.
Hmm.
You can't just do it first, middle, initial, last name. So that's really what they're looking for. They're not looking to see if your handwriting has changed so much as they're looking that you're signing the exact same signature
okay.
that you would have done on your driver's license.
One more quick call from Fort Lauderdale. Andy, you are on line 6. Thanks for calling in. Quick question. Go ahead.
Hi, Professor. I'm just wondering, is it possible that, there's one voting machine somewhere that, the Scantron reading process didn't catch the Senate race, and that could result in this many votes? How many ballots
do
these machines
It's possible.
Cover?
It could be what we call how the machine is set up. It's possible that there were some machines that weren't reading the bottom left corner of the ballots well. And therefore, there could be marks, and they didn't get picked up.
Hmm.
And it's possible that there's a handful of machines. It would have been more than one precinct. because the numbers are too great.
It's about 30,000 right now. But, Andy, great question. And, Professor, thanks for your time and sharing your knowledge with us. Charles Zeldin with us via Skype, professor at Nova Southeastern University. You are rewriting the syllabus for next semester, I imagine, over the next few weeks, aren't you?
I am definitely rewriting the syllabus, and we all are.
Yes. Charles Zeldin, thanks, Professor. Appreciate
Thank
your
you
time. I
me.
Know we'll have you back here. Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, stick around. We got to talk about two Democrats flipping two congressional seats in Miami-Dade County, going from red to blue, and the delegation sent to Washington. That's next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Democratic challengers won back two congressional seats from incumbent Republicans in South Florida. Donna Shalala succeeds retiring Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton in District 27. That stretches from southern Miami-Dade County up along the coast and includes most of downtown just south of MIA. Here's Shalala on her election night party in Coral Gables.
We want our community back, we want our country back, and we want our state back. This campaign has always been about the American dream, about making sure it's there for everyone.
Shalala ran against Republican Maria Elvira Salazar. She is a longtime Spanish language journalist and commentator, made her connections to Dade County a big part of her campaign.
I was born, I was raised, I have worked for 35 years as a journalist in this town. I know the whites, the blacks, the Jews, the Haitians, the Cubans, Venezuelans, the Hondurans, the Puerto Ricans, and the Dominicans.
That was in the 27th congressional race, flipping from red to blue. Meantime, further south in the 26th congressional district, Democrat Debbie Mercosal-Powell beat Republican incumbent Carlos Curbelo. She becomes the first Latino person elected to Congress in Florida who's not Cuban. WLRN asked Mercosal-Powell whether her victory could be part of an ascent of non-Cuban Latino political clout in Miami-Dade County. Here's what she said.
I don't want us to think that this is a division or any sort of referendum against anyone. I think that we're just people that have been working in this community that are bringing up our voices as Hispanic elected officials. It's a new generation, right? I mean, I think that we're progressing in a different direction, and I'm very optimistic about what that's going to bring for us in Miami-Dade and in Monroe.
So two previously red districts flip blue, helping the Democrats take control of the U.S. House of Representatives. How did that happen? What does it tell us about the demographics of South Florida and the voters in South Florida? Let us know your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or on Twitter at WLRN. Leslie Clark is a reporter with McClatchy's D.C. Bureau. She's with us via Skype from Washington. She spent a lot of time on the ground here in South Florida during the campaign. Antonio Delgado is with us from our studios at the Miami Herald. He's been covering the races for El Nuevo Herald. Antonio, let me start with you. What do you think the results in these two districts tell us about the changing demographics of voters in the 27th and 26th districts?
Yes, hello. Like you were saying, it kind of shows how much of a has been changing the demographics inside these two districts. As it happened in the 2016 election, they show clear signs of turning more to the Democratic Party. In the District 27, where Donna Shalala won this week, President Trump lost to Secretary Hillary Clinton by a margin of 19 points. Now, that particular race ended up being more competitive, more closely fought than initially thought. On the Curbelo against
Mercosal-Powell.
Mercosal-Powell, it was very tight, very close race. She ended up winning by less than 4,000 votes. Even though Curbelo was well liked in the district, but as you were mentioning earlier, I think that the community has been changing with the migration of people from different countries in Latin America who might be more moderates and actually more liberals than Cuban-American community have been throughout the years, and I think that's beginning to show in the way that South Florida is voting.
Yeah, Leslie, let me ask you about that. Leslie Clark with the McClatchy News Service in Washington, D.C. You spent a lot of time here in South Florida. Mm-hmm. You reported in South Florida for a good number of years as well. You know these races and these voters. The Cuban-American representation in Congress with this election goes from 3-1. Ross Layton obviously retiring, Carlos Curbelo losing in his reelection bid. And so the sole Cuban-American representative in the House of Representatives will be Mario Diaz-Balart, who did win reelection in Dade County.
Yeah, on the Republican side.
On the Republican side, right.
Yeah, you've got a couple on the Democratic side. Well, you have one, Albie Osira is up in New Jersey. But yeah, Democrats for years have been talking about these districts. I mean, I remember when I was down there full time, they were always telling me that they thought these districts were beginning to trend to their favor. And, you know, they've been able to do it this time around. There's just a lot of new people moving in and a lot of people, especially like sort of on the coastal parts in the city of Miami, that are leaning Democratic.
And so how does that change the representation of the South Florida delegation into Congress, into Capitol Hill? And as the Democrats take the majority in the House, Leslie, by a very thin margin right now, just one vote. How does that change the makeup, the composition?
Well, it's going to make it a lot interesting. I mean, especially you've got Shalala coming in, who was a former Health and Human Services Secretary, the longest serving in U.S. history. So one assumes that she's going to have, you know, a great deal to do with sort of health care policy under the Democrats. And it, like you were saying, that it completely changes, shakes things up for the Cuban-American Republicans and sort of opens up Democrats beginning to try to chip away at what has long been held by Republicans. And you have to kind of look back to when Dante Fussell and another number of Democrats sort of ruled the roost in South Florida.
You got to have your political history put together to remember that name, right, Leslie?
You got to go way back.
Yeah.
I don't go that far back. But.
And neither do I. Antonio, I don't know about you, but yeah, we're all students of political history. But let me ask you, Antonio, to this point here, what about the strategies that you saw deployed, especially in both of these races, and how they differed, not just by language in terms of Spanish language strategies and English language strategies, but the changing political strategies to gauge the Latino vote that is not as monolithic Cuban American as it was just even a couple of election cycles ago.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, one of the things that Maria Elvira Salazar did, and we kind of saw that in the clip you played in the beginning, was that she tried to portray herself as a product of Miami. And then she was trying to get voters to identify with her, in contrast with Donna Shalala, who was very visible, very well known. But she was that was not the profile of the regular Hispanic voter. So she played that well, and I think that gained her a lot of votes. Now, it wasn't the only factor in this race. This race had different things going on with the people trying to, conservatives trying to get more support to President Trump, and the other side trying to do the opposite. And issues like health care also came into play. But I think she was able, Maria Elvira Salazar was able to get people to identify with her, trying to, those that might vote more than in favor of somebody that might feel represents them better than the other person. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the factors why she did so well in this election.
We did see the Democrat, the winner here, Donna Shalala, make a real, I guess, targeted appeal to Cuban Americans as well by trying to draw attention to her extended family Cuban roots.
Yes, we saw a lot of that. And I think she did try to connect with the Hispanic community, even in some of the debates that were held in Spanish. And although she was speaking in English and had somebody translate, she was willing to participate, even though it was an environment that she didn't seem to be very comfortable in.
Let me correct a designation I had earlier here. Mercosal Powell, Debbie Mercosal Powell, the winner in the District 26 congressional seat. She will become the first Latina elected to Congress in Florida who is not Cuban. Chaz in Coral Gables wants to talk about the Republican relationship with Cuban Americans. Chaz, thanks for calling in. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hey, thanks a lot. So myself, I'm rather bristle at that nomenclature, you know, for Cuban American. And there's like, there's a book actually written, Living on the Hyphen. What does that actually mean? What is that identity? You know, when does Cuban American actually become American, right? And for that matter, when does it become Cuban, right? But the same exact argument that Republicans love to tout, that the Democratic Party are patronistic and, you know, somewhat parochial towards African Americans, I find that to be completely palpably mirrored between Republicans and Cuban Americans. All right, and I have to say that I have resented that all of my life. I have voted Republican in some elections, but since the 2000s, I've voted Democratic. And I think that what's happening is that the Cuban American title is slowly but surely turning into American.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to put that out there because then the last thing I want to say is I really find it funny that a Cuban American Marco Rubio senator is against counting all votes after being such a stalwart defender of democracy in Venezuela and Cuba. And of course, you know, damnifying and vilifying, rightfully so, those two governments and the way that they've been held, you know, holding their mock elections. So can we please have one principle and apply to
Chaz,
all? Can we please do that?
I hear Marco your plea.
Rubio, I hope you're listening, Senator Marco Rubio.
I hear your plea, Chaz, and I know the senator on social media has pushed back a little bit about that characterization, saying that he has not called for stopping the vote count that continues here on this Friday afternoon. But what about what Chaz is describing there, Antonio, the kind of hyphen Americanism, generally speaking, but also how it plays out here in the diversity of the electorate in South Florida?
Yeah, and I think some of this is also changing, but I think traditionally the Cuban American community has been very conservative, tends to keep a strong eye on foreign policy, particularly as regarded to Cuba and in the last few years to Venezuela. And I think that's been the main factor that have been dominating their vote. Now, the second generation Cuban-American tends to be more less conservative, more moderate. And you might see that those second generation and third generation Cubans might be leaning more towards the Democratic Party as opposed to their parents and grandparents.
I want to ask both of you, Leslie and Antonio, about kind of how identity politics has played out in these two races. And what I mean by that is this hyphen Americanism that Chaz and Coral Gables talked about, especially as it relates to Cuban American and the Cuban American vote. We heard, you know, with the Andrew Gillum campaign, critics calling part of his political platform socialism, progressivism, far left leaning. All of those are phrases that certainly echo in the Cuban American and the Venezuelan American community because of what Cuba and Venezuela have experienced and are experiencing in terms of their politics and their economies. And so I ask both of you, how did those play out during the campaigning? And what are we to make of using that strategy in the campaigning with the results that we saw on Tuesday? Leslie?
Well, I think Shalala actually sort of took advantage of this this idea of getting everybody into different camps, different tribal divisions. She would use that constantly to rail against President Trump. And a lot of this election was, a lot of voters that I talked to, at least in Miami-Dade, told me they were very much interested in delivering a message to Washington by electing a Democratic House. And that's a lot of people were backing her because of that. And I think she sort of used that anytime people would talk about, you know, well, she's not Cuban American, she's not one of us. She'd come back and say, look, that's the politics of hate, that's the politics of division, that's what Donald Trump is all about. And she was able to tie her opponent very well to Donald Trump and benefit from the anti-Trump sentiment among Democrats.
Antonio's much the same, although slightly different, but in terms of tying the incumbent candidate in the case of the 26th district to the president in the form of Carlos Curbelo, and especially regarding his vote on the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, there were. That was highlighted during the campaign. I think he was being accused constantly in different TV spots of actually voting against that, and it might have played an important factor here because, as you might know, 90,000 people within that district mm-hmm. benefit mm-hmm. from that program, and I think that was one of the most heated issues in the campaign. The position against the Nicolas Maduro regime and the Castro and the Cuban regime, I think it might have taken a second seat in this election, and people was more interested in issues like healthcare and the economy.
Hmm. Interesting. Nolly in Miami on line 6. Go ahead. Your thoughts on this.
I'm curious to understand how two specific demographics affected this vote, specifically Puerto Ricans, as how the whole natural disaster was affected by Irma and Maria, all of that, as well as the Haitian vote, because I think that falls under a category of African-American under census data. And there's a lot of mixed people in my South Florida that are both Latino and still identify as African-American. And I wonder if the rhetoric and all of that, since we haven't been focused on as economic, you know, Trump and this administration is not focused on Miami as economic only as opposed to real estate. So I'm curious to know how those groups and if there is any surveying to understand how that.
Yeah, now I appreciate that question. I have not dug into any of the exit polling just yet, Leslie. I don't know if you or Antonio have seen anything in regards to the Puerto Rican or the Haitian vote, generally speaking, or specifically in these races.
No, in those, that has always been a really tough thing to tell. Even with the Cuban American vote in Miami years ago, it's always really hard to get the exit polling on specific groups that are like smaller than the overall general electorate. So I haven't seen anything and I don't know if anything exists on it.
What we do know is that a Puerto Rican candidate who was an incumbent for the Florida State House, Robert Asensio, in the House 118 race, lost his effort to return to Tallahassee. Again, not reading anything into that, but just saying, he was among the first Puerto Rican candidates to be sent to Tallahassee from South Florida. And that was also seen, Antonio, a little bit of, is that a result of some changing demographics in that district?
Yeah. And like Leslie was saying, I think it's very difficult to know how many Puerto Ricans actually live in those districts. We know that there's a greater number of Puerto Ricans coming to the States. Some of them have been settling down in other areas, not so much in South Florida, but they're also here. So, and I think that the results might have taken into account some of that. That might have played a factor in this election, but we just don't know by how much.
Not yet. Certainly that data will be coming out in the days and months ahead. But first, there's still questions about some big statewide races and the results that that we're still waiting for that matter. Antonio Delgado, a reporter with El Nuevo Herald, with us from our studios inside the Miami Herald. Antonio, great to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing your insights and reporting with us.
It's a pleasure.
Leslie Clark, covering politics with the McClatchy Washington, D.C. Bureau, with us via Skype. Leslie, you wore out a pair of shoes, I'm sure, reporting in South Florida, but great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for your time as well.
Thanks so much for having me. Always a blast to be in Florida and covering politics.
Absolutely. Always never a dull moment. Still to come, speaking of which, the city of Miami, voters there moving forward with plans for a new soccer stadium, but say no to a strong mayor. That's next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening. David Beckham Soccer Stadium got the green light from City of Miami voters this week. But a day after the election, the stadium deal faces a different roadblock, an ethics complaint filed last week over improper lobbying. Miami voters also voted against Mayor Francis Suarez's strong mayor proposal for the city that would have made him the most powerful person in city government. Here's Suarez on WLRN Sundial.
If you want to be mayor of a big city, you have to be comfortable with responsibility. What bothers me is when there's an incongruity between what the expected ability of a mayor is and the actual ability of a mayor.
So let's talk about how the city of Miami voted with these two issues, the aftermath of these city referenda. Miami Herald reporter Joey Fletcher is with us from our studios inside the Herald in Doral. Brittany Shamus is a staff writer for the Miami New Times, who recently wrote a profile on Mayor Suarez. To both of you, Joey, welcome back to the roundup. And Brittany, great to have you on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Joey, let's talk about this ethics complaint, first of all. Does it, I mean, while voters said, go ahead, we want the city to negotiate with the Beckham Group about the possibility of a soccer stadium, does this ethics complaint just put that to, does it stop it in its tracks?
It does. According to the city attorney, who sent an email to the city saying, don't meet with the soccer team because of this ethics complaint. We need to wait until the ethics commission resolves it. Functionally speaking, even though the voters did speak, yes, because of the outstanding complaint, the legal advice to the city commissioners, to the administration, is to not have any conversations with folks lobbying for the team.
Walk us through what the ethics complaint alleges.
So there are business entities that have been set up to represent the interests of the soccer team, a couple of them. And what happened was one of them, Miami Beckham United LLC, had lobbyists registered, which include David Beckham, Jorge Mas, and a few other people and some other lobbyists.
Jorge Mas is among the owners of this new team. He's also with the MasTec Corporation.
Right, right. And so they were registered through the city, clerk, to be able to lobby. Another entity, Miami Freedom Park LLC, which is the name of this project that was approved by voters, its preliminary terms of it were approved, they were created, they're a Florida corporation, and they do not have any of those principles, Beckham, Moss, registered as lobbyists to be able, and those were, and they spoke, Beckham, Moss, and a few other folks spoke in favor of the Miami Freedom LLC project when the commissioners decided to put this on the ballot in July in a public vote. So this might sound like a technicality, and it certainly is. It's a procedural issue, but it does raise questions about, like, why that didn't happen and, you know, why the T's weren't crossed and the I's weren't dotted. So that's where we're at.
While it may stop the process as the ethics group figures out this this situation, does it? Is there anybody claiming that it could invalidate the vote or invalidate the voting? Not the process of the vote, but the fact that it was on the ballot in the first place.
I'm not sure that that's reached this point.
Okay.
I don't see or hear of anybody trying to raise that particular point. This, at the very least, is stalling the process. Which who knows what kind of impact that'll have on whether or not this stadium complex comes together in a timely manner, which is what ownership has said they need to
and
happen.
Timely manner meaning they want to be able to kick off in a new stadium by
2020. Now, okay. Well, not in a new stadium by 2020. They do want to field a team by then.
Right.
But by the time they field the team, they want to have at least permits issued and the process of review process started for a new stadium.
So, Brittany, let me bring you into this conversation because the mayor, Mayor Suarez, the mayor of Miami, pushed for this, helped endorse this. Referendum passed. The other significant referendum that had his fingerprints and his, you know, his personality behind was the Strong Mayor referendum, which did not pass. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But how much of the mayor is tied up in the stadium? How much of the mayor's kind of political capital is tied up in the stadium?
I think that he has, because he has pushed it in the way that he has and spoken in favor of it, that what happens with this affects how people view him. And I mean, I think he is definitely tied into the soccer stadium because of the fact that, you know, he kind of has gone out there and spoken in favor and endorsed it.
This is a defining issue for
right.
his leadership. Is it not? Is that overstating it?
I mean, I don't think it is because I think, you know, the soccer stadium is something that is a big deal for the city of Miami and something that obviously people, you know, are talking a lot about. And so it's tied into him in a way that, you know, it could really impact what people think of him and how they view him.
Yeah, certainly. And certainly the city commission as well, right, Joy, in terms of the interplay between the approval of the soccer stadium process and the rejection of the Strong Mayor referendum.
Right. When you put those things together, I think it does have an impact on his political clout and perhaps the strong mayor more than the stadium. But no, let's not forget that the stadium is the approval that was that the voters gave on Tuesday was for the negotiation of a lease agreement. There is none right now. And so once that lease agreement is hashed out, it does have to go to the commission and it needs 4 out of 5 votes. And so who's going to whip those votes? Well, if Francis is in position to, you know, if he supports the lease as it's written, you know, he could be one of the people that that the soccer team would want to get convince those commissioners to vote one way. And, you know, he's going to need some influence for that.
Brittany, as we mentioned, Mayor Suarez's efforts were also concentrated on the strong mayor proposal. It failed. Voters rejected that. How does that fit into his career? And give us kind of a quick timeline with the Suarez family and the strong mayor idea in the city of Miami.
So the Suarez family has been pushing this for a very long time. And Francis Suarez himself has been pushing it for a long time, too, since before he was the mayor. And in fact, before he was even on the commission back in the late 90s when there was an attempt made to push to this form of government. Francis Suarez was in college and he was, you know, mentioned in the Miami Herald as having been handing out palm cards and trying to convince voters to support this initiative. Mm-hmm. So and then once he got on the commission, he makes 2 unsuccessful attempts to get the commission's support for this issue. So, you know, this has been a big thing for him that he's been trying to do for a long time. And he's only been the mayor for about a year.
About a year. He was a commissioner for 8 years prior and was the son of a mayor, a 2-time mayor, as a matter of fact.
Right. And so, you know, he didn't take a lot of time before he started, you know, as mayor, making this one of his big initiatives. And I think he was saying, you know, right out from the gate that this was something he was going to work on. So,
Joey, what about the opposition that Mayor Suarez, the current Mayor Suarez, not the former Mayor Suarez, his father, but Francis Suarez, Mayor Francis Suarez, has experienced in terms of the Strong Mayor initiative, not just the voter rejection, but even prior to that?
Well, they certainly share some of that opposition in the sense that a key commissioner on the dais, Joe Carollo, a famous foe of his father, of Xavier Suarez, and now Francis Suarez. He came out and he actually sued to try to get this referendum off the ballot. He came out when that didn't work. He campaigned strongly, raised money, launched a bunch of attack ads, and a political ally of his, Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, did the same thing. So there was external and internal pressures politically on Suarez as the Strong Mayor thing went forward. And well, now that the votes have been cast, it's interesting to see whether that you know actually is going to impact the way he interacts with his own legislative body in City Hall. Correa wasn't the only commissioner against this. Also, Manolo Reyes, he spoke vehemently against the idea, against the concept. And so, it's important to note, I think, that this represents one of the first true pushback moments, like for Francis Suarez politically in his career. I mean, maybe the closest we've come to it so far is when he attempted to run for mayor in 2013. That didn't work out for a few reasons, and including, you know, some issues with his campaign staff having issues with ballot fraud. But yeah, this was this was the voters rebuffing Francis Suarez for the very first time at the ballot box.
And Brittany, what do you make of how he may react to that politically as he tries to navigate these waters? Clearly, an ambitious politician, somebody with deep roots in Miami. He's made no bones about that, and you've written about that. But how do you think he navigates this now?
So, I would not be surprised if he, made another effort to try to get the Strong Mayor thing through again in the future, just going from the fact that he's pursued it several times in the past. So I don't know if maybe the language of a future proposal would be different in a way that voters are more comfortable with it, but I would not be surprised if this came back in some form.
There were pieces of that language. There was a contention over the salary of the mayor and a Strong Mayor. There was even contention that under the Strong Mayor proposal, if the mayor was ousted from office, that mayor would still have the ability to appoint his or her successor, even if they were recalled. So there were some real concerns about how the referenda would be put into play. And of course, it would be in play after Amara Suarez, because that would be the form of government.
Right. And I think what you mentioned about the appointing his own successor was something that was really concerning to people who saw this as being just a crazy amount of power and almost like a dictatorship is some of the language that was used.
Some of the critics were used. Yeah. Brittany Shamas with the Miami New Times. Thanks so much for joining us, Brittany. Appreciate you sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
Joey, always a pleasure to have you as well, sir. Joey Fletches, covering the city of Miami for our partner, the Miami Herald.
Thank you. Thank you.
That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. It is produced by Alexandra Gonzalez, our engagement producer, Kitty Lepre, Teresa Frontato, our digital director, news director, Terrence Shepard, Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director, director of radio operations, and technical supervisor today is Peter J. Mertz. Director of radio programming is Jason Zabka, a crew of dozens. Thank you so much, Charles Michaels, Doug Peterson on the engineering staff. I'm Tom Hudson, and thanks to you for calling, listening, and supporting Public Radio in South Florida.